Barclays Bank boss Bob Diamond swallowed the poison pill during the week and did what everyone said he should do and resign over the bank's rate-fixing scandal. More banking bodies are following, I'll warrant. Roll out the tumbril. Rather more seriously, and what I've long suspected, evidence has emerged that Palestinian President Yasser Arafat was murdered. No prizes for naming the prime suspects. Apparently, a new realm of science and physics dawned during the week with the discovery of the Higgs boson particle. What is it? Good question. And what does it all mean? Well, no one's quite sure, and that includes me. Katie Holmes was quite sure that, after all, the world's highest paid movie actor wasn't for her. She and Tom Cruise are divorcing. Apparently, Scientology, not science, is to blame. The fallout is bound to be millions of dollars. All that and much more in this anniversary edition of The Real Deal. Welcome to The Real Deal on Press TV, still the voice of the voiceless. And to this, the 200th edition of The Real Deal. I'm George Galloway, and every week I'm in London bringing you the news and views you just won't get in the corporate media. Shooting from the hip and shooting from the lip, as always. But if you wanted to fire back at me, you could, at least by email, at the address showing on the screen. Another week, another banking scandal. Last week I told you that Barclays had been fined £290 million for attempting to manipulate the rates on which banks lend to each other. This goes back to 2008 and the original banking scandal. Barclays boss Bob Diamond said when he read emails from his own staff about this, he got physically ill. It sure made his customers, whose loans had been hiked, throw up too. Although unlike him, they'll continue to have to pay. Diamond was paid around £14 million a year in salaries and bonuses. Public and political pressure forced him to take responsibility for his rogue traders and resign. No one has yet said, though, what his payoff will be. Perhaps they're still counting the pound notes. So, they've discovered the Higgs boson particle, have they? It's named after an Edinburgh University physicist, Peter Higgs, who was the first to speculate that it existed because it was too tiny to observe until they spent several billions on a large device which bashes atoms together in a massive tunnel outside of Geneva. What is it then? How to explain it? As one tweeter put it, if life as we know it is an infinite knitted scarf, we, along with everything else, exist in the minute spaces between the stitching, which in turn is the Higgs boson. Any the wiser? No, neither am I. I was a close friend of President Yasser Arafat. I first met him in 1977 in Beirut. He fed me eggs with his own hands. And I was with him when he died in Paris in 2004. And I've never believed the official account, which was that he died of a stroke. Immediately after his death, the first suggestions began to surface that actually he had been poisoned, murdered. And now, after a 9-month investigation, it seems that this could very well be the case. The deadly radioactive isotope polonium-210, the same substance used to murder the Russian dissident Alexander Litvinenko, has been found in profusion on his clothes and on the toothbrush of the late president by a prestigious Swiss medical institute. Now his remains may be exhumed and tested for the radioactive poison. I'll be talking about President Arafat, what he meant to me, and what happens now, later in the show. The movie actor Tom Cruise is being divorced by his wife, Katie Holmes. Sources close to her say it's all about the role of Scientology, the crazed cult of which Cruise is a member, and I presume its prize asset. My studio guest may not be an expert on Scientology, but he is on movies. He's Matthew Alford, author, analyst and cineast. Matthew, welcome again to this special edition of The Real Deal. Now, we're going to talk mainly about the role of the CIA and the US Defense Department in Hollywood, but Scientology must be an influence too, given the prevalence of the cult within cineasts and people involved in the movie business. You got any take on that?
Well, it's certainly an influence on the individuals within Hollywood. Whether it affects scripts or not, I'm not so sure. From my personal perspective, when I went to Hollywood for the first time, really, last year, doing some principal photography for a film I'm making, it was interesting to go down the Hollywood Boulevard and to see all of the tat, really, the frip and the finery of Hollywood, next to Planet Hollywood and all of this glitz and glamour. You know, in the centre of all of that, there's a Scientology building selling hundreds and hundreds of Scientology books by L. Ron Hubbard. It's a peculiar thing. It's a bit like having a Shinto tribe thing in the middle of a Butlins or something like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. But L. Ron Hubbard does seem to have his adherents. There's, of course, Tom Cruise, most famously, but John Travolta also. But you haven't ever seen any evidence of the cult influencing Hollywood movies?
It's not something that I've looked into. The thing I'd be more interested in is the role of the Department of Defense. And that was the other major building that I saw in Hollywood, which I thought was very interesting, is the Oppenheimer building, which is this giant skyscraper in downtown LA. And on the seventh floor of that, you know, several acres wide, is this the office where all of the CIA and Department of Defense, as well as the Coast Guard and other government organizations, work on scripts day and night to try and influence the propaganda.
Well, we're going to come to that. Now, you wrote a book in 2010, and you were good enough to come on the show and talk about it, and you're now making a film about the very same subject, the role of the Defense Department, arms companies, the CIA, and the U.S. government in general in influencing movie scripts. And I was fascinated at the time by that. Has it gotten worse, gotten better? Are they still the elephant in the corner of the Hollywood room?
Yeah, they're definitely the elephant in the room, because although the Department of Defense acknowledges that it does get itself involved in movies, it does so fairly quietly still. The only way really that you'd know that the Department of Defense has worked on a script is to look at the end of the credits. But that has to some extent been opened up a little. Like, for instance, with the film Art of War, the one that was sponsored by the Marines recently, that was very overtly, Act of Valor, sorry, that was very overtly sponsored by them, to the extent that they had Marines actually as the main actors within it. So that's opened up to an extent, but if anything, it's got worse, because you've got films like Battleship, which are, you know, making hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, huge budget, and Battle Los Angeles as well, which, and Transformers, the whole series is not just sponsored by Hasbro, you know, the toy company, but also by the DOD, and across, you know, multi-agency, not just the Army, but also the Air Force and the Navy. So it's become huge. It's become bigger business than it ever was just in the last few years.
And the CIA?
CIA's involved as well.
Sort of movies have they been involved in, and what kind of role have they played?
The CIA has been involved in a lot of movies, including ones that are fairly critical of the CIA, like the Bourne films. But more commonly, they work behind the scenes very quietly. Nothing's really written down that we can find. Certainly nothing's been declassified through the Freedom of Information Act, very little. But they also work on things like The Sum of All Fears, for instance, which is the Ben Affleck film from the early 2000s, just to basically paint the image of the CIA as a very positive organisation that is there to protect national security. Obviously, no question of things like waterboarding getting on in any of those programmes. Sometimes it's very extensive, the role as well, in that they'll literally work, they'll provide extras for the programs, for instance. So there's the series at the moment, which is called Covert Affairs. There was a series, a film called In the Company of Spies. Various TV series and films have been made with extensive CIA backing, and that has gone back to the 50s as well. Even films like The Quiet American, back from then, had influence directly on set by the CIA. Although at that point it was actually more interested in censoring anyone and working with the Production Code Administration to censor anyone who was thinking about even mentioning the CIA, which is why, even though the CIA was invented in the mid-40s, no one actually mentioned it in Hollywood until 1959 in the North by Northwest by Hitchcock.
Wow. Now, did the agencies, the CIA, the Defense Department, do they come along after the fact, once they know that there's going to be a movie made? Do they then say, look, we can help shape, on the grounds of accuracy, no doubt, what you're going to say about us? Or are they actually proactively seeking to have films made that will take a certain political line in relation to them?
It's a bit of both, I think. I mean, going back to the Tom Cruise example, the sequel has been repeatedly suggested to Top Gun that this is going to somehow happen. Now, one of the interesting things about that is that amidst that speculation, the latest article that's come out about it is not a statement from any Hollywood producer, Paramount or anything like that, who are making the film, but from Lockheed Martin. You know, an arms company is talking about the kind of products that it's going to be placing in Top Gun 2, all the while...
Now, that's an interesting one, because Top Gun 1 was a dreadful movie, in my opinion, but made a fortune and made big stars out of several people. And Tom Cruise, of course, went into the stratosphere, you could say, after that, in terms of Hollywood stardom. But it had another impact, didn't it, on recruitment to the United States Air Corps?
Well, yeah, it had that definitely had that impact. The Pentagon admitted it. In fact, they celebrated it. They said that recruitment was up by 500% in the weeks that were immediately following the film. And it was very much about a recruitment product for them. In fact, I was reading up about this, and they Paramount offered to have an advert for to join the Air Force at the beginning of the film on the DVD to try and make a bit of money, because they obviously owed the Pentagon a little bit of money. And the Pentagon just said, no, we really don't need a 90-second advert. You've got an hour and a half here as an advert. Yeah, so, yeah. No, we're not having that. And the interesting thing about the sequel to this is that, well, I mean, it could well, you know, it could well happen and then reignite this all over again. And will it create that same level of buzz and that same level of...
And what's the role of censorship in this? You used it en passant just a minute or two ago. If you and I wrote a script and someone bought it in Hollywood to make a film in which the CIA had a certain role, would they ask the Hollywood moguls for the right to vet, censor, what we were saying about them, and would the moguls agree?
Well, I mean, films can get through without moguls looking over scriptwriters' shoulders the entire time. So I think you've got to be a bit careful about the way that sort of conspiracies work. I mean, perhaps the most interesting example I found, there's a Warren Beatty film. Actually, you know Warren, don't you?
Very well.
From the late 90s called Bullworth, which great actually film. Used that... The terrible, unsayable word socialism in a movie, and it was endorsing a socialist idea. And I was confused by this because I looked at, you know, I was looking at it and I thought, this is made by Fox. It was made by Rupert Murdoch's company. And it's one of the only films you can see from the Fox repertoire that is, you know, genuinely critical movie. And then I read up on it more and found that Beatty had been saying that he'd had to make the film in complete stealth. He had managed to very skillfully negotiate total creative control, and of course, when Fox found that, you know, he had made this movie, they just thought it was this apolitical thing about a guy who
went crazy.
Goes crazy.
We've only got seconds left, so let me ask you about your movie. When is it coming out? What's it going to be called? And what can we look for in it?
All right. Well, the title of it is The Writer with No Hands, and it's about the disappearance through, we don't quite know why, the disappearance of a screenwriter called Gary DeVore in the late 90s. And I've been in touch with his widow and many of the people involved in the case, including national security advisors, who have suggested that there is something untoward going on with the disappearance of this man and that it involves the national security.
It's a fascinating story. Can we expect it in the next, 12 months?
Well, we're wrapping up principal photography in the next few weeks, and then we'll be looking for a distributor, so we'll have to see. The Writer with No Hands.
The Writer with No Hands. Is there a website?
No, not yet. We'll be publicising it in due course.
But... I'll be publicising it myself. Thanks very much for that, Matthew Alford, as always. Joining me now from Jackson, Mississippi, is Bill Chandler. He's the top gun in the Mississippi Immigrants' Rights Alliance. Welcome to The Real Deal, Bill. Your Supreme Court has ruled out key parts of an Arizona law on immigrants, which critics like you argued could lead to racial profiling. So do you see it as a big victory?
I think it's a partial victory in view of the fact that making felons out of unauthorized workers was struck down. Forcing people to carry papers regardless was struck down. And also, making it a state crime to violate the provisions of the federal immigration law was struck down. However, the racial profiling part of it was left standing basically pending further legal action. And that would be dependent on somebody challenging that because they were racial profiled. And for the rest of the South outside of Arizona, this also is a significant but partial victory as well, because we had three deep South states, that is South Carolina, Georgia, and Alabama, that had passed similar provisions like Arizona. And in fact, Alabama was worse. But a coalition that we have here in Mississippi has been able to defeat attempts to pass that bill for many years. In fact, over 250 bills have been introduced in the Mississippi legislature to attempt to make life miserable for immigrants in this state. But we have defeated it primarily because of the leadership of African-American organizations that have joined with immigrants and other groups to defeat these measures.
Well, as you ran through the names of those states, Bill, it struck me that you probably won't have to wait long before you have an actual case of racial profiling. Is that how you see it?
Yes. There actually have been law enforcement that on their own, not only here in Mississippi, but all over the country, have use their own power as law enforcement officers to stop people based on how they look. And we expect that there will be a challenge very shortly in Arizona, if not from other places.
And how has it gone down, this partial victory, with the right-wing, racist, anti-immigrant forces in these states? Are they taking it lying down, or do you expect a bit of a backlash?
Well, we expect a backlash. Here in Mississippi, the governor here is a Tea Party person, and very much like the governor in Arizona, who we refer to as the Wicked Witch of the West. And he is going to attempt to introduce legislation again when the legislature convenes here in Mississippi in January.
Now, you said African-American organizations were key. That's a pleasant surprise in a way, because one of the things we have here, and I'm sure you do there, is that it's sometimes possible to co-opt minority ethnic communities into an anti-immigrant stand on the principle that more immigrants puts more pressure on the lives of minority ethnic communities who are already under pressure.
That has been a concern. However, because of the history of struggle here for equal rights, African-American organizations throughout the South, you know, have been supporting immigrant rights in their states. But particularly here in Mississippi, we have been organized for over 12 years. Our leadership of our organization is African-American. Half of our board is African-American. The other half, of course, are Latinos. And others. And it is very important to have these kinds of coalitions.
Indeed. Hallelujah. Bill, the very best of luck to you, and congratulations on that victory, albeit a partial one. That was Bill Chandler in the state of Mississippi, MISSISSIPPI, as I recall. But now it's time for some very important fighting talk. Now, I said earlier in the show that I'd come back to the deadly issue of the death of Yasser Arafat, who was a friend of mine. I first met him in Beirut in 1977. He took a liking to me. I stayed with him for a long time, and politically speaking, stayed with him for the rest of his life. And I was there at the Percy Military Hospital in Paris at his demise. Amongst his veteran comrades, of which I was proud to be one, there was a discussion as he lay dying, which was not based on whether or not he'd been murdered, whether or not he'd been poisoned. That was taken as read, but on the question of by whom and how. We were in no doubt that what was happening to our comrade Yasser Arafat was not natural in any sense of the word, that someone somewhere had killed him. Now, to my shock, there was no post-mortem on the body of Yasser Arafat. And I learned this week, to even greater shock, that the Percy Military Hospital had destroyed all of the specimens from the tests that they had taken on Arafat when he was still alive and when they were treating him, even though French custom and practice is that such specimens, such test results, have to be kept for 10 years. And it's only been 8 years since the death of President Arafat. It came as a great shock to me to hear the allegation this week that on his underwear, on his socks, on his toothbrush, and even on his trademark keffiyeh, there were enough traces of the deadly radioactive isotope plutonium-210 to suggest that he had been murdered in the same way as the Russian dissident Litvinenko had been murdered in London. After an assignation, we were told, very clearly we were told, with an agent of the Russian KGB, because we were told by all the news media that only a state actor with access to such nuclear materials could possibly have caused someone's death by the use of this material. Well, of course, there is a nuclear weapons possessing state actor with every incentive to have killed Yasser Arafat, and that state actor is the so-called state of Israel. I am in no doubt at all that Israel murdered Yasser Arafat. The voices of Ehud Olmert and other leading figures in the state of Israel, including the mass murderer Ariel Sharon, had already told the world that their previous promises that they would not kill Arafat were now null and void just before he was killed. A more important issue for me is how Israel was able to murder Yasser Arafat by the use of this deadly radioactive material. How did they get close enough in the ruins of his compound in Ramallah to carry out this murder? Did they have accomplices at Arafat's court who allowed them to carry this murder out? Who knew what about this murder, and when did they know it? That's why I'm calling on this show for an international tribunal to investigate the murder of President Yasser Arafat, for the exhumation of his body from its tomb in Ramallah, so that we can establish beyond doubt the cause of death. I'm calling for an international tribunal like the one that they called for the death of Rafiq Hariri. Yasser Arafat was not less important than Rafiq al-Hariri. We need the same international attention into how he met his end. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for, but God willing, there'll be more at the same time, in the same place next week. I've been George Galloway. This has been The Real Deal on Press TV, and you have been a wonderful audience.